It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. You know, every January, the consulting firm Eurasia Group issues its predictions for the year of the top 10 global risks for investors. But it's not only interesting to investors. So even if you're not, say, managing a portfolio of emerging market securities or some such thing, it's always an interesting take on some of the top global political situations and national security situations of the moment and likely for the year. So back with us again this year is Eurasia Group President Ian Bremmer. Ian, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's nice to be back with you.
If it's
a little tradition.
If it's the new year, it must be Ian Bremmer coming into our studio. Does this have your number one risk this year is America's troubled alliances. That's your term, America's troubled alliances. And this is not to warn of dangers from our enemies like Iran or al-Qaeda, but the state of our security partnerships with our friends like Germany, France, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Brazil, all on your list. Why does that top your list of global risks?
Well, you know, it tops our list because it has such an impact on the way we think about the global economy. I mean, for so long, the growth of the U.S. markets has been American companies going all over the world, investing all over the world. And that's becoming much more challenging in an environment where the countries that have most facilitated that are suddenly have very big questions about the nature of the commitment of the United States to them and what American leadership means. I mean, the U.S. is not in decline, but American foreign policy actually is, and that is really new.
What do you mean by the U.S. is not in decline, but American foreign policy is?
Our economy is clearly doing very well. The dollar is actually very strong. People are still investing in the U.S. The rebound, of course, is in place. Unemployment is still much higher than we'd like, but much lower than it was a couple years ago. But U.S. foreign policy, if you think about the implications of the Snowden NSA scandal with our friends that we've been spying on, we're even less popular as the world's private investigator than we were as the world's policeman. You know, you think about the impact of the Syria, U.S. Syria policy, on again, off again, red line, not really. Are we going to support our allies or not? Look at the government shutdown and the fact that Obama last minute was not able to make that trip to the APEC summit and slowing down. We were supposed to announce the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is probably the single most important U.S. foreign policy piece of policy in the last decade, supposed to be done by the end of 2013. Hasn't gotten done, probably won't get done this year. All of those things are making American allies wonder, what does it mean to be really close to the U.S.?
So the security partnerships of these allies may be shifting, is what you say, among France, Germany, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, countries like that. But why would it matter to investors who these countries, relatively still friendly to the United States, have military or national security alliances with? If they're politically stable and they're happy to trade with us, isn't that good for business in any case?
Well, states are becoming much more important as actors in their economies. That's a big change that we've seen since 2008, not just because of the rise of emerging markets, but just because of the follow-on from the financial crisis. And I'll give you a few examples. The most obvious one, if you're Lockheed Martin or you're Raytheon, you're not selling more to the U.S. government because defense spending is flat, but you're trying to sell a lot to Saudi Arabia or to Turkey. Those countries are increasingly turning their defense dollars to other countries. So that's one. A second, if you're Cisco or Apple or Google or Facebook and you want to do business in Europe or in Brazil, and suddenly those countries are saying you have to have data centers that are local and you have to prove to us that you're not giving your information to the NSA, the costs of doing business for those companies in these countries, allies of the U.S., are actually going way up. And if the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the two biggest trade deals out there, don't get done or don't get done soon, then trade flows and capital flows don't move to the U.S. the way they would have otherwise.
Related to this is, I think, number four on your list of risks in the coming year, and that is simply Iran, which is notable, I think, because your paragraph on this cites both risks and opportunities from Iran. We have the 6-month interim nuclear deal now that includes some easing of economic sanctions. Do you see both risks and opportunities with Iran in 2014?
I do. And linking it to the first risk, as we just did, you know, U.S. foreign policy has gone in a fairly negative direction on most things. But Iran has been one of the thus far notable successes of U.S. foreign policy, both under Bush and under the Obama administrations. And if Kerry gets it done internationally, that'll be seen as a big feather in his cap, which thus far has been pretty empty. This is the year for Iran. The last several years, it's been tough for sanctions. They've been continuing to move on their nuclear program, but it hasn't moved that much, right? We haven't had much to talk about. This year, either there's a deal, in which case oil prices go way down and the Saudis are really upset and the Iranians get a lot stronger and everyone invests, or the Iranians go nuclear. And so do the Saudis. And we have a very big fight on our hands in the region. And we will know that this year.
Very much in the news today are the common interests that the U.S. and Iran suddenly find ourselves with because of the fracturing Middle East situation generally, that Al-Qaeda-linked Sunni rebels are on the rise in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. And these groups are enemies of both Iran and the United States. So how much opportunity do you see for a new alliance of all things based on Iran being the enemy of our enemies?
You know, just Secretary Kerry just 48 hours ago made it clear that the Iranians would be invited into the talks on Syria. And that was not even conceivable even several months ago. So I think there is a lot of desire on the part of the United States to improve the relationship with Iran. There's a lot of interest in doing so, not just in terms of alliances in the region, but America and Iran share another interest that's important, which is both countries would like the U.S. to play less of a role in the Middle East. And you know, the United States would love to say they're not going nuclear. We've got a deal. U.S., our work is done here. Everybody go invest. Lots more oil getting produced. We've got an energy revolution. We don't need energy from the Middle East anyway. Why are we spending our time here? The Iranians would love that outcome. There are a lot of people out there that would not like that outcome. It's clear the Israelis wouldn't. It's clear the Saudis wouldn't. And there are many in Congress that wouldn't as well. So I think it's very much up in the air whether a deal gets done. But if you ask me to make a bet right now, does a deal happen? It's a close call. I think it's going to.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, our guest on WNYC. He's out with his annual report of top political risks for investors around the world. But as I said at the beginning of the segment, this isn't just of interest to investors. This is always an interesting global political analysis when we have these conversations, when these lists come out from Eurasia Group every January. By the way, Ian will be speaking at the Carnegie Council for International Ethics on January 14th. From 6 o'clock p.m., the event is open to the public. Again, that's January 14th, which is, I guess, what is that, a week from today, next Tuesday.
Yes, it is.
6 to 7:45 p.m., Carnegie Council for International Ethics, if you want to go see him in person. Your number two political risk for global investors this year is what you call diverging markets. But what you describe there seems to me to have a lot to do with democracy, that voters in emerging market countries, including India, South Africa, Colombia, Turkey, Brazil, will all be holding elections this year as rising middle-class populations are frustrated by slow growth. Why is that a risk if all these countries have expanding middle classes and democratic elections?
Yeah, because, you know, when economists think about middle classes, they think that here are folks that we can sell more shoes to. That's a positive. We want to see bigger middle classes. When political scientists think about middle classes, they think about increasingly powered segments of the population that make demands of governments. And sometimes those governments will react effectively and well and strategically, and sometimes they won't. And if you look back on 2013, look at the demonstrations in Turkey, look at the demonstrations in Brazil, millions of people on the streets with economies that were not functioning very well, causing a lot of instability. We've seen that in Egypt, too, and across the Middle East. In 2014, clearly in the run-up to the elections, all of these governments are going to be throwing money at populist policies, at local constituencies, which is not going to make the markets feel that they're heading in a good direction. The question will be after the elections, which of those governments actually decide that they're going to start governing well for the long term? And some will, like Colombia and Brazil, and some won't, like Turkey and like India. And so what we see is that as we get through this extraordinary period of every major emerging market that could have an election is having one. Russia doesn't really have fair elections, and China doesn't have them, period. But everyone else is. Coming out of that, these emerging markets are going to have completely different trajectories. And so for those people for the last years that have said, oh, let's go into the BRICS, we have to just stop thinking about the emerging markets in a coherent way.
And your number three risk is the new China. But from what I've been reading, the new president, Xi Jinping, is cracking down politically but loosening things economically, like allowing more free market competition against the big state-owned enterprises. Wouldn't investors have reason to be bullish on China right now?
Yes. Yes, they would. And it's exciting to see that finally, after 20 years of China doing very little in terms of economic reform, they're now actually doing it. They're opening up the financial sector. They're cracking down on local corruption in the state-owned enterprises, particularly in the energy sector. There's a massive experiment with a new free trade zone in Shanghai where anything that isn't explicitly illegal or prohibited to invest in is open, which is a Gorbachev formulation. Hmm. Did you think you were ever going to hear that from the Chinese, right? But the fact that they're now starting to reform means that there will be losers in China. There will be lots of elites that are disenfranchised, a lot of people that were doing very well with the old system, thank you very much, that will no longer have access to very cheap capital. And that's one of the reasons why this is accompanied with a political crackdown. They don't want the New York Times reporting openly on what's happening in China, nor do they want dissidents locally in that government. They understand that what they're doing is actually dangerous. And so the risk here is that taking the steps that are desperately needed in China domestically actually creates that you're opening a bit of a Pandora's box. These are unprecedented steps in the world's second largest economy. There's also a risk that they will take some of the nationalism that comes up and divert it externally, as we're seeing in Japan. And the Japan-China conflict is a real one.
Let's take a China call from a listener. George on the Upper West Side. Hi, George. You're on WNYC.
Good morning. I'm concerned about what are called the shadow lenders in China, the trust companies, all these specialized finance companies, most of whom have been used as an outlet to finance much of the growth that's happened. It touches a little bit on the corruption issue, but the bigger issue is that it sounds almost exactly like what we had happen in the United States before the 2008 crash. Now, the Chinese have just issued a new edict, supposedly guiding the central bank and regulating this sector. But what I'm still unable to read and understand is, in fact, what all this means. I'm very worried about the black swan effect. If there's going to be something that's going to cause a worldwide financial crisis and crash again, it could be exactly this sector.
It can't be. And the reason why it can't be is because, unlike the United States in 2008, the Chinese still don't have a banking sector. You can't short them. It was The Big Short. Michael Lewis wrote that big book, right, about, you know, sort of how you had a small number of empowered and very, very wealthy hedge fund operators who were able to basically bring down Lehman by bearing all this pressure on the shorts. That can't happen in China, absent an open financial system. But you're right that there's all of this shadow banking, and I do believe that they're going to start allowing bankruptcies. Five of the seven leaders in the Standing Committee of the Chinese Communist Party right now actually have their terms up in 2017, and they happen to be the ones that are most focused on financial reform. So you are going to have folks that will be brought low, that will lose tons of money that in China, and that probably will end up being arrested. And when that happens, you're going to have a lot of upset in the Chinese system.
You're not worried that China might have a huge real estate crash that will affect the whole world? They could have a real estate crash, some people say, because the government has driven so much big office building and residential apartment building development in so many cities in China, so many cities that are big cities by any global standards, but that people in the United States have never heard of, but, you know, fostered by government to create infrastructure. But a lot of those office buildings especially are going empty because there isn't the demand. So could there be a real estate crash in China that has huge global implications?
Well, the ability of the Chinese government to continue to fund, given their surpluses, given their cash situation, is there. So I think they have the ability to move that incrementally, to actually not pop the bubble, but to let the air out of the balloon, sort of over the course of many years. They're also engaging in hukou reform, which is their land registration. And one of the things things they want to do is allow for urban migrants to receive social benefits, which will allow more efficient transfer of folks from the rural areas into these cities. There are still hundreds of millions of Chinese that want to live in these cities. They're not there yet. The infrastructure isn't there. The scale of China, not just the scale of the overhang of real estate, but the scale of the demand for moving into cities still boggles the mind.
So you're bullish on that development.
I'm still bullish on that.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. We'll finish up here with Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group, which every January issues a list of top political risks for the investor community for the coming year. But as we've been saying, this is usually a very interesting global political analysis, not just a business analysis. So let's finish up with a couple of things. Here's an interesting one from your list. One of your risks for this year is called strategic data, which is about a shift in the internet from an open source bottom-up environment to a top-down government-driven one. Is this like the NSA data collection and things like that?
It's more than that. I mean, you think about what drove globalization and the sector of the economy that was most clear, not a part of the state, but a part of, you know, private entrepreneurship driving extraordinary global wealth was the internet. It was the information revolution. It empowered individuals. Nobody knew if you were a dog on the internet, right? And that, you know, Google didn't care what government you were part of, what country you were part of. They just wanted to be for anyone around the world to connect to them. Well, very big things have been happening. One, China's now the world's largest internet market, and they see data as a threat and as a consequence of political instability. They want to be able to monitor, control it, and they want Chinese companies to be the ones that are doing business there. The second point is that the United States, which is a free market economy, sees data as a part of the military industrial technological complex. And the National Security Agency, you know, really says we need to have our hands all over this. We need to be aware of who's trafficking and what kind of data.
This is the stuff that Snowden pointed out.
In extraordinary and breathtaking form. And when you put those two things together for the U.S. and China, which are the world's two largest economies, you suddenly take a sector that was the world's most driven by the private sector and most aligned with globalization is suddenly one of the world's most strategic, most attached to states. And that means that it's fragmenting, it's becoming more inefficient, and your relationship with governments as private sector corporations, not just in the internet, but also for banks that deal in data, for credit card companies, for telecommunications companies, AT&T, Cisco, and the rest, this is becoming a very big deal.
Last thing, I noticed that not on your list this year is the Fed pulling back on quantitative easing. Are you not concerned that that's going to cause a global round of deflation?
I am not. And, you know, everyone says, oh, my God, when they were talking about tapering last year, the emerging markets took it on the chin. Yes, that's when they were talking about it because there was uncertainty. Once they actually started tapering, the market impact was to shrug it off. And that's because it's very, very gradual. It's being handled by someone who has very much the same orientation towards the global markets, Janet Yellen, as we've seen from Ben Bernanke. Furthermore, it's happening as the U.S. grows and in a relatively low energy price environment. 2014, energy prices are likely heading downwards, even without an Iranian deal, from the U.S. energy revolution, from Mexican reform, from places like Libya and Iraq, which are very violent, but where oil is continuing to expand. So if you put all of those things together, a relatively mild taper is a non-event in 2014.
Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group. And again, he'll be speaking at the Carnegie Council for International Ethics next Tuesday at 6 p.m. That event is open to the public if you want to hear him talk more. Thanks so much for coming in. Really interesting.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come, we will look at that bizarre murder story from Williamsburg of a landlord kidnapped and set on fire. Roberta Kaplan, the lawyer who argued that Supreme Court case that ended the Defense of Marriage Act, she'll be with us today. And children's book author Kate DiCarillo, author of books like Because of Winn-Dixie and The Tale of Despero, now the ambassador for young people's literature from the Library of Congress. Stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.